So today we're going to look at, we're continuing our look at the figures on what's called the refuge tree of the Western Buddhist order, looking at these historical figures throughout Buddhist history and what they can teach us, what they can say to us about how we practice, how we can practice the Dharma here and now. And we've got on to the Japanese teachers on the refuge tree. And we've come to Kukai. And Kukai is actually arguably the most important of a lot of the Japanese teachers. He sort of allowed Buddhism to use certain sort of features of, if you like, the Japanese mindset, Japanese character and worldview, in a way that was really important and that really influenced subsequent teachers in Japan, like Dogen, who we've heard about, and Shinran, who we will hear about. And it's also important for us because in some ways there's certain similarities, I think, between our culture and the Japanese culture in a way that makes it easier for us to get into some aspects of the Dharma through that rather than through ancient Indian culture. In particular, Kukai's approach to the Dharma, which I'll say a lot more about later, but it, as it were, validated, it gave value to and it used the beauty of nature and the beauty of art as important parts of the spiritual life, which isn't always there. I mean, traditional Indian culture doesn't seem to have quite so much about the beauty of nature. And some schools of Buddhism sort of reflect that. It's as though the material world around us is just something we have to completely transcend. It's just something that's got no good in it at all. But a sense of awe and mystery and beauty in the face of nature seems to be very much part of the Japanese mindset. And I think it's also part of a lot of aspects of the Western mindset. It's been part of the British mindset. A lot of people experience, what I've just said, sense of mystery, a sense of awe, and a lot of beauty in nature. And it's very important that we sort of bring that into our practice, that we don't just exclude it. And that's what Kukai did. He explicitly incorporated into Buddhism a sense of, if you like, sacredness of the natural world, sacredness of beauty, and even the sacredness of ordinary life, if you like. So we can see that in the influence that he had. We can see the influence, for example, in Dogen's advice to the cook. So a few weeks ago, we heard Ratnaprabha talk about Dogen's advice to the cook. And one of his bits of advice was treat everything with reverence. Treat the ingredients with reverence. Treat the utensils with reverence. Approach the act of cooking as a sort of sacred rite that you do for other beings and for the universe. And this sense of the world and ordinary life as a sort of sacred arena in which we act, which every act we do has got sort of real meaning, is full of significance if we only open our eyes to it. That's very much there in many schools of Japanese Buddhism. And Kukai seems to be the man who put it there. So it's quite an important influence. And he's a hugely important figure in Japan, where he's often called Kobo Daishi, which means the great teacher who spreads widely the Dharma. Something like that. He's sometimes regarded as the inventor of the kana syllable script used in Japan, even as the founder of Japanese culture sometimes. He's seen as a great civil engineer and a great mobiliser of the population, who was this terrific magnetism, managed to mobilise the people to do things like building reservoirs, etc., etc. He's seen as a wandering holy man, a poet, a calligrapher, an intellectual, a scholar. So he's a man who reconciles a whole load of different opposites in himself. He renounced the world, yet he led a very creative and constructive life in the world. He loved nature and the wilderness and solitude, yet he became one of the most influential cultural leaders in the capital. And that's sort of expressed in his name, Kukai. Ku apparently means sky, and kai means sea. So it's sort of like the union of two opposites, sky and sea. So there's that aspect of unifying opposites, which comes out particularly in terms of the opposites of rationality and clear thinking on the one hand, and a vision of the supra-rational, what's beyond reason, what goes beyond reason on the other, what goes beyond logic and reasoning and the thinking brain. He very much combined those two. So what about the man himself, first of all? I mean, a little bit about Kukai and his life. He was born in 774 by the Christian calendar, so a long while ago. He's quite an early figure in Japanese Buddhism. And he was born into one of the noblest houses in medieval Japan. He was given an excellent education. At 18, he entered the highest educational institution in Japan, the Daikaku College in the capital, where the sons of the nobility were educated to run Japan, basically to run the nation. There he followed a Confucian curriculum, and he read widely in the classics and in history, but he developed a particular interest in Buddhist scriptures while he was at the college. He came to see Buddhism as sort of offering a higher set of spiritual values than Confucianism, looking at the world in a completely different way. And he became discontented with the whole approach of the college. He wanted to know the truth. He wanted to know what it was all about, not how to be a good official. So he walked out. He left the college. And it's quite an act, actually. I mean, he was turning his back on a lifetime of prosperity and security, the normal lifestyle for people of his class. Turned his back on that, got himself ordained as a Buddhist layman, and went out into the wilds, into the mountains, into nature, to meditate and reflect. Just took himself off. And for something like 13 years, he followed the lifestyle of a homeless holy man. Sometimes living in hermitage huts deep in the mountains. Sometimes putting up with hunger and cold, probably very rarely getting enough to eat. Living on the simplest food. Sometimes staying for a while in a monastery and studying the scriptures. And at some time during that point, maybe 13 years, he seems to have been ordained as a novice monk. And he may have been ordained, he may have received full ordination, but it's not particularly clear whether he did or when he did. But during this time, whether he got ordained or not, he had some big spiritual experiences, which he described in his writings. Some associated with the Bodhisattva Akashagarbha, who at one point he saw coming for him with a sword, which can't have been much fun. And he also had a vision of the planet Venus, where the planet Venus came and went into his mouth. So, I don't know. What's that about? I don't know. Union with the universe? I don't know. Anyway, that's one of the visions that he describes. But perhaps most significantly, he had a dream. He had a dream. He had a dream in which a venerable old man appeared to him carrying a sutra, carrying a book. And he said, "This is the Mahavarochana Sutra. And this is what you need to practice." So, you know, I mean, he was really searching. He was really intensely searching. So he woke up with this sense of excitement and joy. And he'd been told what he needed to practice. He had to find the Mahavarochana Sutra, practice that. And it had actually been translated into Japanese. And he managed to find a copy. And he got hold of a copy. And he opened it up. And he couldn't understand what on earth it was talking about. It was complete gobbledygook as far as he was concerned. Which is maybe not surprising because it's a tantric text. It's a tantric text where really the text that's recorded only points to the teaching. You need the oral commentary from somebody who's received the oral commentary themselves. It often refers to meditation practices, and if you haven't been taught that practice by a teacher with experience of that practice, it just doesn't mean anything. So he got the Mahavarochana Sutra, and it was like, yeah. But he'd been told that this was what he had to practice. So he started looking around for somebody who could explain it to him, somebody who could tell him what it meant. And in the end, he looked around in Japan for some considerable period of time and decided He didn't think there was anybody in Japan who actually knew what this sutra was about. There was nobody who had been actually part of the lineage, part of the tradition of that style of practice. So he decided he wanted to go to China. He wanted to go to China. Buddhism always came to Tibet through, came to Japan through China. China was where it came from. He wanted to go to China. And he got himself included in an expedition to China. At this time, I mean, China, as far as Japan was concerned, China was the center of civilization. Japan was a sort of bit of a rough outlier somewhere. And so the emperor of Japan periodically organized trips, expeditions to Japan, where a number of boats would be kitted out, and people of all different sorts, scholars, artists, officials, and holy men of one sort or another, Buddhist monks, etc., would be taken across to Japan so that they could learn what they could learn in a specific period of time and then take it back to Japan. And that was a sort of, that happened quite a lot. We heard about how Dogen went on a similar mission. And Kukai got himself included in such a mission to China, which might not have taken so much doing, because we are told that whenever the emperor got it into his head to organize such an expedition, all the officials in the court would start to panic. And some of them would run away. It was so dangerous. It was such a dangerous thing to do. Some of them would actually run away in case they got included. And some that had been included and couldn't get out of it suffered nervous breakdowns about it. Because it was a stormy sea, and this is 8th century, something like that, and Japanese boats apparently weren't very seaworthy, as we shall see. So he might not have had a lot of competition about going to China. In fact, he might have been one of the very few people who actually wanted to, and the rest rather went with their arms up behind their backs. But anyway, he got himself included in this expedition to China, where four boats were kitted out and filled with a selection of officials and scholars and artists and all sorts of things like that. And they set off, these four boats set off, and before long they encountered rough weather and a storm, and they got separated. And one boat sank immediately, killing everybody on board. One boat was forced to turn back to Japan and then set out again and sank. And two out of the four got to completely different parts of the Japanese coast. So you can see why people perhaps weren't so keen on these expeditions. But Kukai was on one, was lucky, he was on one that got to the Chinese coast. And so he set about finding himself a teacher who could explain to him what on earth the Mahavarochana Sutra was about. And he was dead lucky. He was dead lucky because he came across somebody called Master Hui Kuo, who was a direct spiritual descendant of the man who introduced that teaching to China less than 100 years earlier. It was introduced by somebody called Viryabodhi, who came from India, who introduced that style of practice, passed on to somebody called Pu Kung, who passed it on to Hui Kuo. So he was just two away from, as it were, the person who introduced the teaching to China. But Hui Kuo, his teacher, who he found, but was by then an old man. And he said he was just living to find a suitable person, a suitable Dharma heir, a suitable successor. And he quite quickly recognized that in Kukai he'd found his successor. It said that he felt that teaching these teachings to Kukai was like just pouring a liquid from one vessel to another. It was so easy, like Kukai was just completely ready for it. So Kukai stayed and he practiced with this man for some time. And eventually Hui Kuo formally recognized Kukai as his Dharma heir. And he said, go back to Japan and take this practice with you, take this style of practice with you. So Kukai eventually found a boat that was going back to Japan from one of these expeditions, and returned, by which time his teacher had died. So he returned to Japan, and he gradually seems to have just had more and more influence. His Shingon school, which is what his school was called, which was based on the Mahavarochana Sutra, I better write that up too, His Shingon school, based on the Mahavarochana Sutra, something like that, based on the Mahavarochana Sutra, gradually became more and more influential. And he gradually became the enormously influential figure that he did, that he became, that I described in the introduction, where he was really just a huge figure in Japanese culture. And then after he died, his school, the Shingon school, continued to prosper. And it still exists today. It's the only surviving traditional tantric school of Buddhism outside of Tibet. So what sort of approach to the Dharma does Kukai's Shingon take? It was a tantric practice. So it uses meditation practices involving visualizations of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and seed syllables and mandalas. It involves these sort of rich meditation practices, and it involves mantras. It also involved art as a way the Dharma can be communicated. So after his return from China, Kukai said, "Since the esoteric teachings of Buddhism are so profound as to defy expression in writing, they are revealed through the medium of painting." So, you know, he's specifically using art as a way of trying to get something across, which is a bit transrational, which goes a bit beyond what you can just say in words. So Kukai's approach was tantric, and secondly, it was based on the Mahavarochana Sutra. Varochana, as many of you will know, means illuminator. And Maha means great. Maha is actually just added to the name for a bit more wow factor. It's like the wow, really big Varochana. Whereas Varochana is pretty big anyway, actually. So many of you will know that Varochana is the central Buddha. In the sort of traditional mandala of five Buddhas looking at different aspects of enlightenment, Varochana is the central mandala, central Buddha of the mandala of the five Buddhas. In a sense, he is often seen as what you might call a cosmic Buddha. He represents the principle of Buddhahood. He represents the enlightened mind beyond time and space. And this is very much what Varochana or Mahavarochana meant for Kukai. For Kukai, Varochana, the Dharmakaya, the enlightened mind, the bodhicitta, and the Buddha nature, if you know what any of those are, they were all the same thing. Varochana was the lot. But Kukai went even further than that. For him, the whole world and all the people in it are Mahavarochana, the enlightened mind beyond time and space. The six elements, earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness, are Varochana, Mahavarochana. They are manifestations of Varochana. In our fundamental nature, you are Mahavarochana, and I am Varochana. And Mahavarochana, who is also us, is constantly seeking to communicate with us so that we wake up to our enlightened nature. So Mahavarochana is seen as constantly teaching, constantly speaking to us all in a myriad different ways. All the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the various tantric visualizations are aspects of Mahavarochana, suited to different people's needs and different people's temperaments. The Mahayana Sutras are the voice, the speaking of Mahavarochana. They're not taught by the historical Buddha, according to Kukai, which is in itself a revolutionary view. So all the other schools of Buddhism taught that all the Buddhist sutras were actually taught by the historical Buddha, which is actually a nonsense. But he was saying, no, they're taught, the Mahayana Sutras are taught, they're the teaching of Mahavarochana, manifesting the enlightened mind beyond time and space, manifesting in the minds of meditators, who then transmit it to others. So all the Dharma teachings are the voice of Mahavarochana, whether they come through him manifesting himself as the historical Buddha, or whether they come as him manifesting himself in another way, like in somebody's mind. All mantras are the voice of Mahavarochana, allowing us to tap into a power beyond ourselves. Art is the manifestation of Mahavarochana. It's the way the enlightened mind speaks through a human artist to communicate beauty and higher values and higher vision to us. Nature itself is a manifestation of Virochana. So the beauty and sense of awe and mystery we can experience in nature, in the mountains, in the oceans, in the stars, this is also the enlightened mind speaking to us. It's the enlightened mind resonating with our enlightened mind. So that's the sort of vision of the world that the Shingon school represents. And according to this Shingon school, the way we become enlightened is to align what he calls our three mysteries, the three mysteries of our body, speech and mind, with the body, speech and mind of Virochana, the body, speech and mind of the enlightened mind. So the first way we do this is by practicing the precepts. He's very keen on that. If we practice, the precepts are the rules by which we align ourselves, put ourselves in harmony with Virochana so that he can begin to act through us, so that we can become who we really are. If we're subject to constant desire, craving, ill will, well, we're just completely out of sync. So the first thing is to practice the precepts. But beyond living an ethical life, we can align our body with Virochana's body by engaging in ritual, through mindfulness of the body, and through mindful action in the activities of every day. We can align our speech with Virochana's speech through teaching the Dharma, through speaking in a way that helps others, and through mantras. And we can align our mind with Virochana's mind through the practice of various tantric visualizations, especially, visualization practices, and all the various tantric figures like Manjusri and Avalokiteshvara are ways in which Virochana appears to communicate different aspects of the enlightened mind to us. So when we meditate on those figures, we open our minds to Mahavirochana. We allow him to act on us and influence through us. So that's the sort of image that's presented. And I imagine at this point some people are going, whoa, that sounds awfully like God. But actually, it's one thing to say is it's very different from the God of the Western tradition, if it is like God. It's a God who is his creation, so there's no separation, no sense of condemnation. It's a God who's you and me, as well as being sort of transcending the world. It's a purely creative God, as it were, if you're going to call it that. But then, I mean, it'd be wrong to start thinking in those terms. It's sort of applying Western terms. Because with this, with all other ideas like it in Buddhism, remember that Buddhism isn't going in for metaphysical speculation. It's not saying, this is the way the world is, and you've got to have faith in that, and then you'll be all right. It doesn't do that. It's not an attempt to explain reality. It's saying, here is a way of looking at reality that you might find useful, that you might find liberating. It's a poetic image. It's a helpful story. It's not dogma. It's not trying to say this is the way things are. It's saying, here's a poetic image. Here's a story that might help us get our head around some aspects of reality. That might help us, and they might be more useful than some of the stories we've just plain inherited from our society and from our family. So aspects of the Mahavirochana story, if you like, that are definitely more likely to be helpful to us than the story we've got from our conditioning. So there are aspects that are going to be more helpful. I mean, one of the aspects we've often got from our conditioning, the story we've been told by our culture and our family, is that the universe, the world around us, is a dead machine made of dead inanimate matter, in which consciousness is just a sort of accidental byproduct in which ethical values and spiritual experiences are just fantasies that are somehow less real than less real than sort of chunks of stuff. So, good, thank you. So this is a vision of the universe. It's a poetic vision of the universe in which reality is trying to help us to develop spiritually, because we are integral parts of reality. There isn't a difference between reality and us. There isn't a difference between the universe and us. It's a vision of the existence in which the universe is not a dead machine, not a mechanistic clockwork world. Instead, it's a vision of existence in which the human mind and the world are inextricably linked, where the universe is constantly seeking to communicate enlightenment to us, where the Dharma and spiritual teachers and the beauty of art and the mysterious beauty of nature are all ways that reality speaks to us. All ways in which the whole, if you like, is communicating to its parts, which are us. To some people, this sort of vision might have a strong appeal. To some people, it might not. But I think there are aspects of this way of looking at the world that we do need to take on if we're going to get anywhere really seriously in the spiritual life. And the most important from our point of view is the vision of being part of a living universe. Yeah? Not a dead universe, but a living universe in which mind is important. Not being trapped in a universe that's like a dead automatic machine, which is, to some extent, the story most of us have taken on for our education. So I'll quote, this is a quote from Kukai. This is Kukai speaking from 800 and something. Many people consider the four great elements of earth, water, fire, and air to be insentient. But in esoteric Buddhism, they are regarded as the body of the Tathagata. That means the body of the Buddha. The four great elements are not independent of mind. Differences exist between matter and mind, but in their essential nature, they remain the same. Matter is no other than mind, and mind is no other than matter. So, for Kukai, the universe is a living universe where mind and matter are two aspects of the same thing, where we are connected, where we're all connected to everything else, to nature and to everything else, in which the beauty of nature is a communication to us, from what is deepest in the universe to what's deepest in us, and where everyday acts are, if you like, meaningful. The universe is like a sacred place in which everything we do really has meaning. Everyday acts are meaningful and even sacred. So the reason perhaps we need to think about this is that most of us have been conditioned to see the universe as I say, a dead machine. This is the vision of 18th and 19th century science. But it's still really influential on the way we think. So the story we've been taught to tell ourselves is that the universe is made out of dead inanimate matter, and it just works like a machine. And life arises within that machine as a sort of accident. It's just some sort of accident that happens within that machine. And our mind and our sense of consciousness arises also within that machine as a sort of accident. Our mind is a sort of byproduct of matter when it organizes itself into a brain. But mind, according to that story, mind isn't real. It's not real in the same way that matter is real. Matter is what really matters. Matter is what's real. And it follows from that view of the universe, which is, you know, the mainstream view, that spiritual values are a sort of artificial invention. That internal spiritual experiences don't have the same validity as our experience of, say, a washing up bowl or a vacuum cleaner. They're real. What happens in meditation is not as real as them. That the experience of beauty and mystery of nature is in some sense just an illusion. There can't be any real beauty or mystery in a lot of dead inanimate stuff that just sort of obeys physical laws. We just, if we've got any sense of beauty or mystery, we're just imagining it. It also follows from that particular story of the dead universe, it follows that we're quite free to exploit our environment in any way, destroy it in any way we like, to make more and better toys for ourselves because, well, after all, our environment is just dead matter. It's just dead matter. And this, incidentally, is a very convenient story. The story of the dead universe is a very convenient story if you want to run a capitalist consumer society, because if you start having to take on board that showing reverence for the world, the external world, might be a good thing, then costs might go up. Profits might go down. So that's part of the story that most of us have been told, actually. And another part of the story we've been taught is that this way of seeing the world is rational and scientific. That's what we've been taught. That's part of the story. And actually, this is just a hangover from 19th century science. Though it's still incredibly influential in the way we are taught science in schools and the way science is seen in, if you like, the soft sciences like biology and psychology, where it's this view of nature, this view of the world, is often held with a dogmatism which would be, well, it ranks with the worst religious dogmatism. It's just held with an absolute dogmatism that you cannot say anything against it. But funnily enough, it's not the way real science sees the world. Real science, modern science, physics, certainly does not see the world as a dead machine in which mind is just a sort of illusion. I don't have time to discuss that in a way that would be convincing, so I'm just going to quote a few eminent scientists. Yeah? I'm just going to quote a few eminent scientists. So here is Sir James Jeans in a Reed lecture. Today there is a wide measure of agreement which on the physical side of science approaches to unanimity, that the stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. Or we've got the epigram of Sir Arthur Eddington, where he just said, he said it much shorter, he said, the stuff of the world is mind stuff. Or we've got Arthur Koestler saying, modern physics is an important step between the demolition of the great superstition of the age, the materialist clockwork universe of 19th century physics. To assert that there is only matter and no mind is the most illogical of propositions, quite apart from the findings of modern physics, which show that there is no matter in the traditional sense. So I could come up with loads more like that. You could just plaster the walls with quotations like that, from Nobel Prize winners to, you know. So if we think that seeing the universe as a living reality rather than a dead machine is somehow irrational and unscientific, I think the least we have to do is accept that there are people who've got far more powerful rational minds than us and know far more about science who don't think so. Yeah. So maybe we just have to step back and be a little humble about that sort of worldview. In fact, some of them have said, the story of the dead universe is the great superstition of our age, as Arthur Koestler put it. So that story of the dead universe is not rational, and it's not very useful in the spiritual area either. It's very useful perhaps for building bridges and motorways and things like that, but it's not very useful in the spiritual area. For one thing, it makes life grey and boring. Nothing has real value in a machine-like dead universe. There's no magic in it. There's no mystery in it. Spiritual values are just illusions. Spiritual experiences are illusions. The beauty and wonder of the world doesn't mean anything. There is no mystery. You might just as well settle down and go for a good pension. Yawn. It's not a good way of following life. That's so at that level. But also, if we live in a dead universe, the ultimate goal of Buddhism doesn't make sense. The goal of Buddhism is transcending selfhood realizing non-duality. That's the ultimate goal. Realizing we are not separate from the world about us, from other people in the world about us. But if the world about us is just a dead machine, realizing non-duality with a dead machine is just to become a cog in a dead machine, which is less than being a human being. We might as well stick to our ego. That would be bigger than being a cog in a dead machine. So realizing non-separateness, non-duality, only makes us more than we are now if it involves us seeing ourselves as part of a spiritual reality, part of a living universe where mind and values and beauty are built in. It makes sense if it means that by non-duality with the universe, we actually express something bigger than ourselves, more spacious than our own little egos, aligning ourselves with the enlightened mind, if you like. So for all sorts of reasons, if we want to get far with the spiritual life, or if we just want to have a meaningful life that isn't boring, we need to put the old story of the dead material universe behind us and bring our universe back to life. So Kukai lived in a universe where everything was Virochana, where everything was sacred, where everything you did had meaning, where everything, if you like, was divine. Other beings were divine, nature was divine, beauty was divine, you know, just the world was a divine place. It was a meaningful, mysterious place. And I think that's probably, there's something in our background, I think, if we go back a long way, that's just almost sort of a natural way of seeing things. But it's as though we've got this sacred universe and we've desecrated it. We've killed it and we've desecrated it. We need somehow to make it alive and sacred again for ourselves if we're going to get anywhere. So I'll read you a quote about that, which is from a book by somebody called Rupert Sheldrake called The Rebirth of Nature. And it's the last paragraph in his book. And he says, "As soon as we allow ourselves to think of the world as alive, we recognize that a part of us knew this all along. It's like emerging from winter into a new spring. We can begin to reconnect our mental life with our own direct intuitive experiences of nature. We can participate in the spirits of sacred places and times. We can see that we have much to learn from traditional societies who have not lost their sense of connection with the living world. And we can begin to develop a richer understanding of human nature, shaped by tradition and collective memory, linked to the earth and the heavens, related to all forms of life, and consciously open to the creative power expressed in evolution. We are reborn into a living world." So that's one man's description of what happens if we bring our world back to life, if we bring our world back to life and don't live in a boring, dead world. I think we can come up with others. I mean, it just validates the whole spiritual enterprise. Otherwise, it's all a bit of a joke, really. Why not go down the pub? It's just the dead chance of universe. So I think it's quite important. I think, you know, we got into the habit of saying, well, what would Kukai say to us? I think that's what Kukai would say to us. He wouldn't say, I'll go for this whole tantric shebang about Mahavirochana, probably. But he would say, bring your universe back to life. Make it sacred again. And here's a few things he might say as to how we might do that. Okay, how might we do that? How might we actually approach bringing a sense of the sacred back into our universe, bringing a sense of mystery and magic back into our universe? I think one is to get out into nature. Get far enough out into it and for long enough to forget human agendas for a while. You can often go out in the Peak District and you see groups of people walking along through these spectacular landscapes. And then you listen to what they're talking about, and they're talking about who's doing what at work, or what three-piece suite they've just bought. I mean, we just collapse our mind onto these totally artificial human things. But actually nature, the experience of nature, if we get out into it long enough, far enough, perhaps in enough solitude, it just makes that seem completely ridiculous. We just start to get a real sense of the mystery of the world. Whereas we close it down, we make it all about human agendas usually. So that's one, get out into nature. A second one would be take spiritual experiences seriously. So especially take meditation experiences seriously. They are real. They are more real. Spiritual meditation or meditation experiences are more real than four-wheel drive recreational vehicles. Don't dismiss them. Don't dismiss them. Remember them. Revisit them. Make them the foundation of your life, like Kukai did. He built his whole life on them. He had a dream where somebody said, you need the Mahavarochana Sutra. That's what his life, that was what gave his life meaning. It was the whole wellspring of his life. So that's the second one. Take spiritual experiences seriously. They mean something. Remember them. Remember childhood experiences, especially childhood experiences of nature and beauty and wonder. So we often see the world very clearly in childhood without all the overlays of the stories we tell in adulthood. Most of us can probably remember times in childhood when the world just looked very special indeed, where something just really seemed to get through to us. We need to remember them, revisit them. That's getting back to a certain sort of reality. So that's my third one. So we got so far, get out into nature, take spiritual experiences seriously, remember childhood experiences. The fourth one is recognize sacred places. We'll come back to that one. I mean, most people experience some places as having a peculiar power. There's a particular church I know in North Yorkshire, which if I go into the crypt of it, I get this almost overwhelming urge to prostrate myself. Yeah, there's something happened in that church. There are places out in nature that perhaps have the same effect. It's that sense of something sacred, something divine in the ordinary, in everyday, you know, in our ordinary environment. Most of us experiences places having a feeling, an atmosphere, a power. So don't dismiss that. Open up to it. Even use it. And related to that is recognize what somebody's called sacred time. I mean, in traditional societies, the year is divided into what I think Dhyavajra has called a ritual calendar. You know, the different stages of the year are marked. Events are marked. Significant times are marked. So maybe we could celebrate festivals. We could celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment, which is coming up. Yay!
Full moon in May.
But we could celebrate the old festivals as well, the old pagan festivals like Christmas and Easter. Nobody's telling me they're Christian. Come on. They're pagan festivals. Let's celebrate them. You know, we don't have to do the Christian thing. We can celebrate them. And, I mean, to me, they've got power. They've got power, I think, to a lot of us. So let's have a ritual calendar. Let's take part in it. Let's celebrate the festivals. Have that sense of making the ordinary something extraordinary, which is what it really is. Another possibility is opening up to gratitude. So we owe everything to what is outside ourselves and to other people, to our environment. We couldn't design our own body. We couldn't even run one of our cells if we had to think about it, yeah? Let alone our whole body. It's all done for us. The universe arranges it all for us. If it didn't, we couldn't take a single breath. We couldn't think about the muscles that we have to use in our legs to move, you know. I mean, it's done for us. And other people, of course, do an enormous amount for us. We owe the universe and other beings everything. But it's hard to have gratitude to a universe that's just dead inanimate matter. So opening up to that sense of gratitude to the universe, of being given by the universe, is one way that we can open up to this sense of, if you like, sacredness in the world. And the last one I've got is open up to the archetypal realm. I mean, this was a big thing for Kukai. The meditation practices on Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and mantras were the way that Mahavarochana spoke to us. They're real. The mental realm in which Buddhas and Bodhisattvas exist is real. It's more real than four-wheel drive recreational vehicles. Open up to that world. Open up to that world. Open up to the world of archetypes, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, myth and poetry. That's my little recipe, which incidentally I owe some of to this guy, Rupert Sheldrake, in the Rebirth of Nature. I've lost my... Get out into nature. Take spiritual experiences seriously. Remember childhood experiences. Recognize sacred places. Recognize sacred time. Open up to gratitude and open up to the archetypal. So you might just want to think about those. I mean, that's a big ask, isn't it? But we're talking about a way of really changing the way we see the world that brings the world to life. And it's really worth tackling that. So my suggestion for a discussion topic for today would be to just pick on one of those. And the one I'm going to suggest is this business about recognizing sacred places. So what I'm going to suggest we might do is just talk about, just split up into smaller groups, and share our experience of places that have got seem to have some sort of power, seem to have some sort of meaning for us, seem to have some sort of atmosphere. Might be from childhood, it might be from adult life. And just see where we get with that. Okay?